WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
On WNYC, and with us now on this Martin Luther King Day, Erin Haynes, who describes herself as a founding mother and editor-at-large for The 19th, a nonprofit, nonpartisan newsroom covering the intersection of women, politics, and policy, and an MSNBC contributor. Erin was previously the Associated Press national writer on race and ethnicity. The 19th, for those of you who don't know it, is the news organization founded last year for the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote, and it's printed as the 19th with an asterisk, the asterisk referring to the fact that in reality, black women couldn't vote until progress made during the civil rights movement decades later. Erin, we always appreciate having you on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much, Brian. And I also declare myself a native Atlantan, so happy to join you as we celebrate Martin Luther King's birthday.
Yeah, and that's not where I was going to start, but I was actually going to get there, and I will. But let me still start with one of your recent articles, which is called Women Overcame the Toxic Masculinity That Defined the Trump Presidency, Then It Was Displayed Anew. And, you know, we talk here a lot about how the insurrection on January 6th was an expression of racism. Can you describe some of how you see it also as an expression of toxic masculinity?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that that toxic masculinity is toxic white masculinity that is rooted in the racial backlash that always attends racial progress as it is made in this country. It was not lost on me in the piece that you referenced, and thank you for bringing that up, that you know, this insurrection happened in the wake of the Georgia Senate runoffs, which, yes, elected two Democrats from Georgia, including for the first time an African American and a Jewish American, but also was really the result of the triumph of voter turnout over voter suppression, as millions of black voters, including many who voted in the runoff that didn't vote in the general election. So even more black voters participating in this expanded electorate that saw the election of Joe Biden and the first black person who will serve as the second most powerful person in the country. And so, you know, all of these factors kind of combined to create a scene that we saw that was violent, mostly white and mostly male. And I think that we have to point that out, even as we talk about the threat to our democracy. What we're really also talking about is a challenge to who can participate in our democracy, whose votes are legitimate, and who is really going to be a part of our electorate, our democracy, and our society going forward.
How much are you worried that the lie about the election being stolen and the push to audit, quote unquote, election systems that were put in place for the pandemic will lead to new waves of systemic voter suppression? And if so, what forms do you think those will take?
Well, I think it's time for everybody to get serious about the 21st century threat to voter suppression, right? It doesn't look like having somebody count how many bubbles are on a bar of soap or how many jelly beans are in a jar. It is certainly misinformation has long been a part of the voter suppression playbook, but it has taken on new forms in this new century. And, you know, that includes obviously threats from overseas and their ability to kind of exploit this country's racial tensions, but also, you know, domestically on, you know, social media platforms, continuing to spread misinformation, disinformation, questioning the integrity of our election. You know, that's something that will persist even as the outgoing president leaves office, because we now as a country are operating from a different set of facts. And so, you know, I think that that also kind of other traditional means of suppressing the vote, as in, you know, through state legislatures, that is also something that, that I think we will probably continue to see, and that folks will have to continue to push back against the closing of precincts, right? The shortage, I mean, the shortening of early voting periods. And even now, as you see African-Americans warming up to the idea of mail-in balloting, something that has long been used by Republicans and white Republicans specifically, as they are beginning to take to that. You know, yes, that started kind of because of the pandemic, but I think it's something that will be, you know, that could become more normalized, you know, for African-Americans or others who have been historically marginalized. You know, what will the attack on mail-in balloting now be now that you see that is an avenue for those voters?
You wrote an article about where Black women political organizers are putting their energy next. And you remind us that in the Senate runoff wins in Georgia, it wasn't just Black voters in urban areas, but also in rural ones that made up the winning coalition. Are there certain states where that can be replicated and built on to have more, you know, historically different outcomes, let's say, as we just saw in Georgia? Because I feel like it's not much of a thing here in my area, in New York and New Jersey, that most of our listeners would be aware of.
Right. So potentially, yes. You know, the Deep South, the Black Belt, in particular, where you have large populations of African Americans, upwards of, I'm thinking, you know, 20-30% African American populations. Many of those folks have not been seen or heard in our democracy, and many also don't necessarily make the connection, or haven't made the connection always, to voting in their daily lives. And then there are others who have made that connection because they live in districts or areas that have been so heavily gerrymandered that in some cases, in some elections, they may feel like their vote doesn't count, you know, because of the way that their voting areas are drawn, that it might not matter who they vote for because it's been the same person for generation after generation. And so as these Black women organizers do not take these voters for granted, as they go, meet them where they are, talk to them about the stakes, not just of presidential elections or, you know, federal national elections, but really the elections that can potentially have the most impact on their daily life, those state and local elections, county commission, city council, you know, school board, those types of things. You know, once they become engaged on that level, and also as, you know, the grassroots organizers that a lot of these Black women, you know, whose names we know, Stacey Abrams, Latosha Brown, Nsei Ufot, and others, you know, as they get the resources to really do a lot of the work that, frankly, they've done informally and unofficially for years, those people can be mobilized and galvanized to make change.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is Erin Haynes, editor-at-large for the news organization The 19th. And as you said at the beginning of our segment, you are originally from Atlanta. I'm curious if you grew up with an awareness of Dr. King, who, of course, was based there, that might have been more or different from people growing up elsewhere in the country.
1,000%, I would say yes. You know, to grow up in Atlanta is to be hyper aware of Dr. King, of his legacy, but not just of his legacy. You know, Coretta Scott King, his widow, who kept his legacy, his memory alive, and who frankly changed this country's perception about who he was. Let us not forget that at the time of Dr. King's life, and certainly at his passing, he was not the hero that a lot of us consider him to be today. You know, a lot of people in this democracy did not consider him to be this beloved figure that we honor and revere and quote on, you know, on Twitter and our Facebook pages right now. You know, she is somebody who brought that about. She would not let his legacy and his teachings of nonviolence be forgotten. She almost immediately got to work on building the King Center in the basement of their home, even as she was raising young children and grieving, you know, his murder. And so I think it's very important to also talk about her. She was with us for decades after he passed, and she was in and around Atlanta and somebody that we could see and touch and be aware of on a regular basis. And also many of Dr. King's lieutenants, including Ambassador Andrew Young, Congressman John Lewis, who we just lost last year, the Reverend Joseph Lowry, the Reverend C.T. Vivian. These people all lived in Atlanta. They spoke out, you know, continued to be on the front lines against systemic racism, against voter suppression, you know, and continuing to push for this country to address institutional inequality. And I think that, you know, just as they did, many of those folks did that until their last breath. That is what Dr. King would have continued to do if he were alive today.
And he would be 92, just for people who don't know, even as we celebrate Martin Luther King's birthday, when he was born or how old he would have been, could have been alive still at age 92, were he not assassinated. What's the resonance for you then of Raphael Warnock being elected to the Senate now from the same position that Dr. King held, pastor of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta?
Well, it's quite interesting to think about that trajectory. Dr. King was somebody who agitated from the outside. He never held political office. I know it's kind of strange to think about that, given his outsized influence on our country's politics and our country's democracy. But certainly the tenets of Dr. King, you know, I know from having covered Reverend Warnock as a reporter in Atlanta for several years, that he absolutely espoused those tenets, and frankly came at his own faith from a social justice perspective, just as Dr. King did, using you know, his pulpit to speak out against racism and injustice and inequality. And so you know, certainly being the head pastor of Dr. King's spiritual home means that he does take a large part of that legacy with him as he heads to the halls of Congress.
You wrote an article on the 19th the other day, looking ahead to Kamala Harris's swearing in on Wednesday, noting that she'll be sworn in on two Bibles with particular personal resonance. Would you start there and talk about what you'll be looking forward to at the new vice president swearing in?
Well, I think that it was important to point that out. I mean, she's going to be sworn in by Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who is, you know, another first, right? The first Latina member of the court. And she was nominated by a first, the first Black president, Barack Obama. And, you know, she's doing this. One of the Bibles that she's going to have belong to Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, who was a first as well, the first African-American to serve on the Supreme Court, who was also a personal hero of Kamala Harris's. You know, she talks about you know, her decision to get into the law because she felt like the law was a tool that could be used to help to perfect our democracy. They also both went to Howard University. Thurgood Marshall, a valedictorian of the Howard University School of Law. And then she, of course, many decades later, as a graduate of Howard University. Dr. King, also a historically Black college university graduate, went to Morehouse College in Atlanta. And so there's a lot of her lived experience, you know, draws on so many, you know, aspects of African-American life, of the lives of people who have not always seen themselves reflected in our democracy. And all of that symbolism will very much be on the dais, I think, as we see her taking the oath of office on Wednesday.
I know you have to go in a minute. Do you have any sense yet of what role Vice President Harris will be playing in the administration? It's different for different vice presidents.
It is. And you know, I think that if the interviews that we've seen with President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris are any indication, they seem very sincere that they plan to be governing partners, much in the way that Joe Biden and was a governing partner to then President Barack Obama. You know, but also they do both talk about confronting racial inequality as one of the four crises that they believe that they will inherit as they prepare to take office. And I think certainly the events of January 6th, showed us that. Joe Biden is somebody who ran for office saying that this was a battle for the soul of America, and has kind of evolved from the idea that this is not who we are to, is this who we want to be, right? Asking the American people that. Couple that with what Kamala Harris said when she ran for president, which is that it's time to speak truth about who and where we are as a country, and that includes speaking truth on race. And so, that could be, a partnership that may well be what is necessary for the type of healing and unity that at least they say they want to try to bring about in this country. But it certainly feels like on this King holiday, a pretty tall order.
Erin Haynes, editor-at-large for the news organization The 19th and an MSNBC contributor. I know you're doing a lot on this Martin Luther King Day, so we really appreciate the time this morning. Thank you so much.
A privilege to spend this time with you.